I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Tell banks they can't charge but so much each time a customer uses a debit card and save consumers some cash on those so-called swipe fees. That's what Congress intended last year when it passed the Dodd-Frank Act. And that new rule is slated to start this weekend. But the banks are finding a workaround. They're imposing new fees to make up for what they won't make on each individual transaction. Several banks are exploring this, and Bank of America is a prime example. It plans a new $5 a month fee for customers who use B of A debit cards to go shopping. Some customers are angry and confused.
I don't like it. They've already given us a $12 fee if you don't maintain a certain balance.
Well, I personally love Bank of America. I'm willing to take $5 charge if it's like that.
Plain and simple, that sucks. I'm not going to pay. I'll keep my money in the mattress.
That was Rick Beard and, before him, Lee Harold and Angela Wells, all talking in front of a Bank of America ATM near our offices in Washington, D.C. Daniel Indiviglio wrote about this for The Atlantic magazine. He joins me here in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us, before we talk about these new fees, exactly what the Dodd-Frank bill did.
Right. So there was a provision in the Dodd-Frank bill promoted by Senator Durbin, and it basically set a cap on how much interchange, which is what they call the fee that is collected on debit cards. So because of that cap, banks are collecting a lot less revenue from these debit cards.
How do these new fees work that banks are using as we described this workaround to try to recoup the money they might lose?
Right. So the big news today, as you mentioned, is this Bank of America's announcement that they're going to charge $5 a month to people who use a debit card. Now, I think the big surprise here isn't that banks are trying to find that money somewhere else, but that they're being so direct about it. Until now, we kind of just all thought that they were going to kind of end free checking, find ways to charge people more for their checking account. But this seems to really be a direct way to get at those debit fee costs.
How do these fees work?
So the way it works is, up to now, it's been indirect. So some percentage of a transaction with a debit card, the retailer that you buy something at will pay to the banks directly. And now since that amount is capped, they're now going to charge consumers directly to make up that difference.
And only if you use your debit card?
That's right.
So let's say you're in a retail establishment or maybe even at a gas station and you have the choice of using debit or credit. If you choose credit, do you avoid the fee?
At this time, you do. There are interchange fees for credit as well, but they're not affected by this particular provision.
And are there other ways that customers can try to avoid the fee?
Cash is, the obvious one. Cash is accepted everywhere, right? So, or most everywhere.
As long as you don't get hit with an ATM fee.
Right.
How are other banks handling this?
Some of the others are testing debit card fees as well. I read Wells Fargo and Chase are both looking at that as a possibility of testing some models. It's going to vary bank by bank. But what tends to happen, especially with big banks, it's become kind of an oligopoly. There's a couple really big ones, and they tend to move in sync. When one institutes a policy, the others do too, just because that's the way markets work.
Daniel, it seems that banks were really pushing these debit cards, in some cases asking people to move away from credit cards and instead take up debit cards.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. And in this case, it looks to me like they must expect a lot of people to stop using debit, right? I mean, if you have the opportunity, if you have a credit card, if you have cash, you don't necessarily need to use a debit card. And if you're going to charge people more for it, a lot of consumers are going to drop off. So I guess they might have liked the deposits that came along with those checking accounts, that people might keep more deposits if they're using debit. And perhaps they just realize the costs of, these debit cards without being able to charge as interchange just aren't worth the rewards for them.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much for coming in.
Sure, thank you.
Daniel Indiviglio is an associate editor for The Atlantic.
When some 2 million federal employees show up for work tomorrow, they'll be starting a new fiscal year. And once again, they'll head into a 12-month budgeting cycle amid uncertainty about government shutdowns and cutbacks. And that uncertainty affects more than just federal workers. NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn Geewax, joins us to explain how the failure of Congress to complete a budget by October 1st can hurt car dealers, home sellers, store owners, and, all the rest of us. Welcome to the program, Marilyn.
Hi, Adi.
So before we talk about the broader economic impact, please remind us, where is Congress on the fiscal 2012 budget?
Congress is where it almost always is in early October. It's way behind schedule. It's supposed to complete this one-year budget by October 1st. But really, since the 1970s, that deadline has been met only a couple of times. So here we go again. Last week, lawmakers agreed to a stopgap spending bill to keep the government open until Tuesday. And then on Tuesday, they'll take up another extension, and this one would keep the government operating until mid-November. But it'll be months before the full budget process is completed.
The annual budget process has become such a circus, and it's so routine that it's a circus, and we all pretty much accept that as normal. But what do economists say about the impact of that?
I called up a bunch of top economists this past week to ask them that question and see what they're thinking, and I got a very consistent response. They all say that this is a broken process that's hurting individuals and businesses very directly.
Okay, what does that mean in detail? How?
Well, let's just start with that immediate impact on the more than 2 million people who work for the federal government. This year, they've been threatened several times with shutdowns, and some of them actually did lose their paychecks for a while. Remember this past summer, there was a congressional dispute over the FAA funding, and it resulted in a partial shutdown of that agency. About 74,000 workers and contractors in the aviation sector ended up losing their paychecks for a couple of weeks while the lawmakers were arguing. And that put a damper on their spending. Should they go ahead and buy a car? Do you make a down payment on a new house? At the time when car dealers and realtors really need people to be feeling as confident as possible, that kind of uncertainty certainly didn't help.
Okay, but most people are not federal employees. So how does this affect the rest of us?
The government affects our lives in all kinds of ways. Let's just go back to that example of the FAA dispute. It directly hurt the FAA workers who were laid off, but the bigger story here is really that all passengers have to deal with costly flight delays because the FAA hasn't had the budgetary direction they need to modernize the whole air traffic control system. The FAA wants to replace that World War II-era radar technology with much more advanced equipment that would speed up air travel. But the agency needs stable, long-term funding to make those kinds of decisions, and it hasn't had that. And it's not just about the money. It's also the squandering of time and talent.
And what do you mean by that? I mean, how could you quantify that?
Well, you know, FAA leaders can't focus on planning for next-generation technology when they have to spend their time making contingency plans for shutdowns, deciding which workers are essential, which ones are non-essential. And, of course, that's pretty demoralizing for the employees who have to go through that process. The best ones may end up leaving government just to avoid this constant drama that involves Congress.
Is this problem, though, really any worse than usual?
I think that economists would say yes, it really is worse this year because the economy is so fragile right now. The European governments are struggling. They have all kinds of political problems with their economy. So investors around the world would like to see some clarity and direction from Washington. The fact that we're starting another fiscal year without a budget is a confidence killer.
NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn Giwax. Marilyn, thanks.
You're welcome, Adi.
Just as unhappy families, at least according to Tolstoy, are unhappy in their own way, so too are economically endangered countries endangered in their own way. That's certainly the impression you are left with after reading Michael Lewis's new book, Boomerang. Lewis visited some of the most financially challenged countries in the world, Iceland, Ireland, Greece, even the United States. And in each case, he found a fatal flaw deeply ingrained in the culture that at least partly explains how they lost their economic way. Michael Lewis joins us now. Good to have you with us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So the world in the first decade of this century, as you explain it, was awash in cheap credit. Each country was kind of like it was left in the dark with a big pile of money. And what they did with that money was very revealing about that country. Can you explain that a little more, what you mean by that?
Yes. You can think about the credit bubble as one giant temptation that was laid before the developed world, that anybody who wanted to borrow basically could, in virtually unlimited sums. And given that temptation, different countries wanted to do different things with the money.
So you set off on what you call a sort of financial disaster tour. And the first country you hit is Iceland. And there you say you have a nation of fishermen who thought that overnight they could become a nation of bankers. Now, first of all, what made them think they could do that?
Fishing has been the source of wealth there. And they've used the wealth to buy lots of education. It's a highly educated population. And then you've got a problem. You've got a bunch of highly educated people who are left to fish. And no highly educated person wants to make a living as a fisherman, or very few do. And when all of a sudden their banks were offered unlimited credit by the rest of the world, every young Icelander was offered the opportunity to essentially become an investment banker. And you ask, what made them think they could do this? It's interesting. They developed very quickly a narrative. And the narrative was, Icelanders have a history of taking risk. Icelanders are kind of genetically suited to be investment bankers.
And it turns out that was not necessarily the case.
It was definitely not the case. The losses were just breathtaking. You know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in banking losses for every man, woman, and child in Iceland. But they basically walked away from most of their debts. So they've kind of gone on their way.
Yeah. And meanwhile, let's go to Ireland now, because the Irish, you say, the famously pessimistic Irish, were discovering optimism. They had an incredible real estate bubble. But as you describe it, this real estate boom had, quote, the flavor of a family lie. What do you mean by that?
Well, in both cases, the banks sunk the country. But the Icelanders' banks did this by essentially handing money to Icelandic tycoons to go buy things overseas. It was a conquering impulse. The Irish, left alone in a dark room with a pile of money, wanted to buy Irish land. And they drove the prices up absurdly. But nobody said it. They all sort of kept mum.
Swept it under the table.
That's right. Mm-hmm. If you think about the Irish history, it's kind of atavistic response. The Irish have always been in less control of their land than most peoples in history. They have had, until recently in history, long experience with nothing but poverty and economic failure.
And as you point out, unlike Iceland, Ireland is going to pay off its debts, and it's going
maybe
to be, well, they're going to try to, or they feel obliged to, let's put it that way.
That's
and it's going to be tough.
Ireland is the nation on earth that seems most willing to suffer to repay its debts to others. Anybody who's been inside an Irish family can explain this. There's a kind of suspicion of happiness and a respect of suffering. There was a moment right after Lehman Brothers failed when Ireland really could have walked away from its obligations justifiably. It wasn't the Irish government that borrowed all this money. It was private Irish banks. And the Irish government made a decision to basically nationalize this obligation. And the amazing thing is that the Irish people did not protest. The Irish people just said, yeah, we have to pay it back.
Whereas in Greece, of course, protests have been quite common.
Greece is in some way the mirror image of Ireland, because in Ireland, the banks sunk the country. In Greece, the country sunk the banks. The banks in Greece were kind of sober, sleepy, kind of reminiscent of a 1950s American bank. What happened in Greece when the Greek people were left alone in the dark room with a pile of money, what they really wanted to do was bloat the state. It was a kind of piñata filled with goodies that everybody got a crack at. And the Greek state borrowed huge sums of money to do things like, oh, I don't know, run the world's most unprofitable state railroad and pay people huge sums of money not to show up to their job, their government job. I mean, enormous graft and corruption. And every level of Greek society was implicated in this. And yet, when they're told it's time to pay, they're furious. Their response is, we don't want to change. We don't want to pay back the money.
Michael Lewis, his new book is Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World. Good talking to you, Michael. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.